once more under the breach, dear friends.
He'll fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
We are both bald, and the first disclosure is that our definition of what an exciting episode may not be the average person's definition of excitement. For us, talking about the Federal Reserve's minutes, we are on the edge of our seats. Hopefully we can bring that excitement to you, maybe, possibly, though I have tried it with my soon-to-be 8-year-old, and I'm missing some things to get that across. I don't know how I can get my excitement over the inversion of the yield curve across to her at this point. I'm going to work on it. It'll be okay at some point.
Yeah.
Right. So disclosures. We're both bald. Jake is bald. Jeff is bald. We're both bearded. Jeff's beard is all white. Those are the first disclosures.
And Jake's beard is mostly black with a few streaks of gray in it.
Yes, yes. So we're telling the other's beard description, so because I can't see my beard right now, and he can't see his beard. So just verify to you, your beard is white. So that disclosure is out of the way. We're also bald. The two of us, Jeff and Jake, are also the principals at another place called the Personal Wealth Coach, not just this radio program. It is a registered investment advisory firm, registered with the SEC. To give fiduciary advice. Does that mean that the SEC approves of us or gives us kudos, attaboys, thank you very muches, or thumbs up of any kind? Any other emojis for that matter besides fixed stuff? No, they don't. They don't do that. They, in fact, if anyone ever claims that they are approved by the SEC, that's kind of a violation of the SEC's own rules. So, no, they're not going to. They don't approve stuff. They do often disapprove things. So, that is their job. Their job is to say no, not to say yes. There. We're registered to give fiduciary advice. What does that mean? It means advice in the best interest of the person receiving the advice. But we can't do that on the radio. Why are we doing the radio then? Well, to educate you. This is not paid commercial program. We are not paid to do this either. We were just looking at this with the new year. I've been doing this for 25 years. Older Baldy here, you did it for what, 27 now? And you were in radio back before the hills got dusty as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Back when we had to bang rocks together to do the radio.
Yes. You bang them hard enough, and you got the resonant frequency required for the tower to pick it up.
Right, and we'd bang on drums, so we communicated by drums in the jungles and so on.
Right. Microphone was the name of the guy that was banging the rocks together. You
right.
Called him Mike. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, you've been doing radio a lot longer than me.
Actually, I started doing radio, I think, in 1965.
Yeah, that's a lot longer than me.
That was a long time ago. 65 yeah. Or 66. I'm not completely sure which year I started.
It's because memory issues.
Yeah.
They didn't keep memory the same way back then. It was a black and white memory, and it wasn't even on a floppy disk yet. So it's really easy to lose that kind of memory just for formatting issues. Yes. Those are disclosures so far. The SEC doesn't approve of us. We're not paid to do this. We don't pay to do this. We do buy advertising on the studio's...
The
radio station about the radio program. So we actually don't advertise our business. We advertise the program.
And of course, the most important disclosure of the day has not been given yet.
Which is that we're bald? No. That is very important, though. I'm gonna say that's the most important one.
I think the fact that the information we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of said information.
See, you only think that's the best one because you get to say warranty, guarantee, deem, accuracy, and completion in the same sentence.
Right. And I think it's really cool.
Yeah. If you say that at a cocktail party, first off, I've not been to a cocktail party in a lot of years. Why do we still say that? But if you said it at a cocktail party, you would either be the center of attention or not. But that's true of almost anything you could say there, isn't it?
Hmm. Well, if at cocktail, I can't remember when I've been to a cocktail party.
I mean, it's a piece of phrasing that still stuck around. Is this from the 60s too? Did they normally have cocktail parties? I mean,
I guess, and I missed them because I wasn't in the correct socioeconomic strata.
Right. Could be. I don't know what rooster tails have to do with parties anyway. This is very strange. Okay, what happened this week in the market? I should say the last, maybe the really most important disclosure, and that we're weird. We're also very nerdly. So what happened this week in the market?
Well, the stock market did, from the perspective of people who invest in it, quite well this week. It's the second week in a row that it's done that. 2023 has been pretty darn good. If we could just keep this up for the rest of 2023, it would be sort of pleasant, but very scary. I think it's ironic. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is the index we primarily use to represent the whole stock market. It's not probably the best index, but it's not the worst. And of the major indices or indexes, depending on how you want to say it, that are advertised and are readily available, it is the most broad. It ended the week at, now this is a good number to remember, 3,999.09. So you can remember that one. That will stick in your brain.
999.09. 3,999.09.
So yeah. It's 3,999.09 on Friday the 13th.
See, it's not a good headline, but it would be a great sales advertisement. You never say your price.
3,999, yeah.
Yeah, you never say the price is a whole number. You always round it down by a penny. And
stock market on sale Friday the 13th, $39.99.09.
Yeah, but on a headline, you always use the round number. All the zeros together make a better headline, but all the nines together make a better sales price. There you go.
I don't know. I think those nines will stick in people's brains.
That's not on any headlines, though.
3999.09. I like it.
Yeah, I like it too.
Well, it isn't on anybody's headlines, but I think it's cool.
It's on our headline.
Because I'm weird. Okay. So there is the 4,000 level is psychologically important because there's a number of
zeros because there's zeros on it. So and, it's psychologically important.
Above 4,000, several pundits have said if the market gets above 4,000, the S&P 500 or the SPX gets above 4,000 and stays there for a couple of weeks, then we're back in a bull market. And they're accurate.
Yeah. Behaviorally, that's absolutely correct. Round numbers are important to us for some reason.
Well, the market for the week, the stock market for the week, meaning the S&P 500, rose 2.76%. Now, if it would just do that for 52 weeks running, that would be pretty cool. Yep. It's up 4.16% so far this year. 2 weeks into the year, we're up 4.16%. It's up almost 11.63% from where it was in mid-October. More and more, and I again, the future is always uncertain, but and you can't tell the future unless you look at the past, and then it's not the future anymore, it's the past. But
it's all perspective.
We wrote this in our newsletter and newspaper column and mentioned it on the radio at the time, but the 12th of October of 2022 looks more and more like the bottom of the bear market. Now, there's still people saying, no, the real bottom is going to come in the near future. I don't think so.
It might. We're not saying it won't, but it doesn't look like it based on what we've seen in history.
Yeah, 40 years of doing this professionally suggests to me that we saw the bottom in October. Yeah. October is a good month to have a bottom in the market, too.
Wait a minute. Let me rephrase that for everyone. We've been around the stock market. We really look at the economy very closely, but we've been around the stock market professionally a long time. I've been around the stock market professionally for 32 years now. You're at the 40-year point. And by that, I'm just trying to say we've seen a lot of bear bottoms.
Now, wait a minute.
Wait, see what I did there?
See, my wife and I had five children. We did see a lot of bear bottoms.
You did see a lot of bear bottoms. Yeah. Yeah. It's true. So we know what a bear bottom looks like. And that looked like a bear bottom on October 12th. There you go.
I've seen your bear bottom. There you go. Anyway.
Those of you that don't know, this is another disclosure. Older Baldy is younger Baldy's dad. We've been working together for 32 years.
It's disgusting.
And this may be a definition of why we're weird, because we've gone slowly insane as a father-son duo over that time period. And we are totally off the market. So I'll hand it back to you.
And if you add a ver to it, it's the truth.
A ver?
Duo-ver.
Duo-ver. Duo.
Yeah.
Ver.
Duo-ver. That's our motto. Anyway, and as far as where the stock market is, as far as its valuation is concerned, it is 79% higher than it was in March of 2020 during the pandemic bear market, the last bear market. So if you remember March of 2020 and thinking, man, I should have got out of the market. I was scared. I wanted to get out of the market. People don't remember that very well because it's so far in the past. I mean, it is almost 3 years.
Almost. I mean, that's a long time.
That is for most people. Just the other day, it was down almost 80%. It's risen 80% since then. So if you didn't get out of the market in March of 2020, and a lot of people did, that's why we had a severe bear market, because we have bear markets when people sell. The market going down only goes down. The stock market declining in value only does so because people are selling. And normally, we see a big sell-off at the bottom. We didn't see a big sell-off at the bottom in this bear market. We did in the previous one. And those people who sold off at the bottom probably are still waiting to get back in. And if they are, then they have missed an 80% gain in the market.
Yeah.
Which is not good. Anyway,
even when we're still in a second bear market since then, it's only 3 years later.
Yeah. Well, if you go back to just before the pandemic, 3 years ago, the market's up, the S&P 500 is up 17%. Why do I carry on about that? The short-term, day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter movements in the stock market.
Century-to-century.
I'm
getting a little ahead of myself. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Short-term moves in the stock market are things that speculators should be concerned about and investors should not. Investors, the shortest time period, the very shortest time period that an actual investor should look at is 3 years. So where are we from 3 years ago? We're up 17%. That number is about to get a lot bigger. And it's about to get a lot bigger, not necessarily because our market at this end has grown that much,
right,
but we are closing in on the pandemic and the bear market. And so sometime in the near future, I will be reporting something to the effect that the market is now up 80-some percent from where it was 3 years ago. And that is the reality. When everybody was selling out of that bear market, was obviously the ideal time to invest because it was an 80% gain. And that has been true in the history of the United States in its stock market. If you buy in when everyone else is selling, which is what John Templeton suggested we be polite and do, be a gentleman
yes.
and do.
Yes, his direct quote is, Sir John Templeton, "I believe in being a conscientious investor. When the market wishes to sell, I oblige them and I buy. And when the market wishes to buy, I oblige them and I sell." It's very kind of him.
Except he didn't do a lot of selling.
He just held on to it, yeah.
So despite all that good news I just said, And it remains nonetheless true. If you look back 1 year, the SPX is down 16.56%. So which is true? Is the market up or down? Well, it all depends on whether you're a speculator or an investor. So if you're a long-term investor, and that's what you say you are, then the market is up dramatically. If you're a speculator, you throw your money in and watch it and maybe yank it out and maybe not yank it out, then the market's down. And so there is a universal truth, by the way.
The difference there, speculation, spectate, that's Latin for looking, watching. Invest means to become part of. It actually means to put clothes on, but the clothes are a uniform. So when you put a uniform of the military on, you've become part of the military. When you're invested, you own what you've purchased. It's part of who you are. When you speculate, you're just watching it to see what happens so you can jump in and out. And there's a difference in understanding of value there. Very, very carefully understanding value. Yes, back to you. I keep interrupting. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that's important about what is going on in the stock market right now is there is historically a high degree of validity in looking at something called a 200-day moving average. It's psychological. Is it certain prediction of the future? Absolutely not. But generally speaking, in about 88.9, I read somewhere, percent of the cases since World War II, at least, when the stock market, measured by the S&P 500 or its predecessors, holds a value for at least 2 weeks that is above its 200-day moving average. So it's an average of the last 200 days in the market, market days, and you take an average of those, and if the current value of the market is above that and holds there for a couple of weeks, then we are in a bull market, whether it feels like it or not. And we have now crossed the 200-day moving average. So remember that 39.99, because if we stay above that for 2 weeks, then there historically, that appears to be a good indicator that we are back in a bull market. And of course, the odd thing about it, if we say, okay, now we're in a bull market, well, that means we've been in a bull market since the 12th of October, but we just didn't know it. And therein is another piece of wisdom about the stock market. You don't know what you're in until you're deep into it and you're looking in the rearview mirror. So you have to have a degree of faith as to where you are.
Or you can this is a really good idea. You just drive backwards really fast. No.
Now here's another aspect.
Never mind.
Here's another aspect of the stock market that we think is very important. We follow another index, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, which is composed of stocks that are mainly in the S&P 500. In fact, I think they're all in the S&P 500. But they're the smaller stocks in the S&P 500. And the price of those stocks appears to be based on the underlying value of the company rather than hope for earnings in the future. So that makes it a different kind. It's called a value. They're called value stocks for that reason. And they're mid-cap. Small caps don't make it into the S&P 500. Anyway, it rose 2.08% for the week. Now, remember that value stocks are the stodgy, slow-moving, boring stocks that people don't get excited about.
Yeah, those boring, just profitable companies that sit there and own things and make money. So boring.
And you won't ever see them in the headlines or anything, but... So it's up 2% for the week, which doesn't sound too impressive, but it's up 5.24% for 2023, which puts it ahead of the S&P 500. But here's the big one. It's only down about 5% from its record high a year ago. So it, instead of being down 16%, 16.5% that the S&P 500 is, 16.56%, it's down 5%. And again, there is a long-term, although not necessarily short-term, truth about value stock investing. Anyway, it's just a little bunch of trivia about the stock market. 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is an important benchmark. It sets the many mortgages and other loans are based on the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield. It ended the week yielding 3.49. Last week it was 3.55. Not a lot of difference. The treasury yield curve still remains distinctly inverted, with the 6-month treasury bill, if you annualized rate of like 4.76%. But it's becoming in a way less inverted because recently.
Can I jump in real quick and say this? Because if you just picked it up listening to this program, what is an inverted yield curve? Is it like the upside?
It's an inverted yield curve.
Like when you come to a sign on the street that's normally a downward pointing triangle, it's an inverted yield sign? No. Typically, loans have higher interests the longer the loan. So if you're trying to get a 30-year loan, your interest rate is going to be higher than if you're trying to get a 15-year loan normally. Because the person, the bank that's loaning you the money or the people that are loaning you the money aren't locking their money up for as long a period of time. So they generally get paid more for locking it up longer. So when you have really, really short-term loans paying a higher interest rate than like the 30-year or the 10-year loans, if you can get a loan right now for 1 month at 4.5%, which is what the government is getting, or you can take a 30-year loan out for 3.6%, why would you take a 1 month loan? So most companies that are intensely trying to grow are taking short-term loans to do shorter-term investing. generally shorter than five-year loans to buy equipment, to hire new people. And when those interest rates go up faster than the long-term loans, it means that those companies that are intensely focused on growth don't grow as quickly or stop growing at all. Some of them go out of business because they couldn't afford the loans they had already. So that's not a good sign for the economy long-term. So back to you. That was a brief explanation.
Recently, the entire yield curve was inverted with relatively low interest rates out at 30 years. And the interest rates rising as you move shorter and shorter and shorter time. It's a severely inverted yield curve. It's the most inverted I've certainly ever seen. And now at least the longer term interest rates are up a bit and the shorter interest rates are up a lot. The low point in the interest rate curve, interestingly enough, is right around 10 years, which is just plain weird. But it's happening, and that's the way life is.
And the high point in the interest rate curve is at the six-month point. It's just weird.
Depending on which bond index you use, over the last 2 years, bonds in general, which are historically considered to be the safe side of the market and, again, boring and not particularly interesting, and they pay steady interest, and that's cool. They're down between 15 and 17%. And if you think back, how far down is the stock market? Well, it's down about 16-point-some percent or 15%, 15 to 17% range, depending on what part of the stock market you're in. So this is an interesting point in the stock market. Is it different this time? It's certainly different than it's been in the past 40 years, because for 40 years, interest rates have been coming down, and we developed this kind of rule of thumb and wisdom among in the public and in some brokers and in some people who really don't understand markets that well. A lot of people believed that if you mix stocks and bonds together, you had a safe portfolio, because if the stocks went down, the bonds would go up, because when stocks go down, we're headed to a recession, the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, which causes bond values to rise. And when the Federal Reserve would raise interest rates, it would cause the stock market to fall. So if you had a mixture of stocks and bonds, you had a stable portfolio. As a matter of fact, there's this mythological stable portfolio that's 60% stocks and 40% bonds. It's the 60-40 portfolio that is often written about and sometimes spoken about as being the traditional safe portfolio, and that's where you should be. Whoa, if you have had a safe portfolio over the last couple of years, your portfolio is down 17 to 20%.
Across the board.
Across the board.
There wasn't a place in that portfolio that saved you.
So it ain't always true. And one of the questions we're going to be addressing, is it different this? It is different this time. Certainly different than anything we've seen in a generation or more. And it's an interesting, for those of us who study economics and the long-term movements of the stock market, it's certainly an interesting time. It's been like 100 years since we've seen this kind of behavior in the stock market. Anyway.
It's a sea change. It's a major shift. It isn't different this time because it's been 100 years since we've seen it. But it's different.
But we didn't.
It's different-er. How's that?
But we didn't see it 100 years ago.
I didn't.
Misstated.
Yeah.
So anyway, another thing we follow besides the Treasury bond and the bond market is the West Texas Intermediate crude oil, which is certainly a fascinating subject to follow over the years if you're a geek like us. It closed out the week at about $80 a barrel, which is sort of interesting. It was $120 a barrel in June, and it was down to less than $30 a barrel a couple of years ago. At one point, for a short period of time, it was a negative $30 a barrel. Oil has fluctuated quite a lot. And this is an important thing to get our minds around. In this particular episode of inflation, there have been two major causes. One was the pandemic, and the fact that we had a lot of people sitting at home buying stuff with money they weren't spending somewhere else. And at the same time, we had a restriction in supply because of people not being able to get to work or not being able to work or being shut down in China or whatever. So we had a supply and demand imbalance, which caused prices to initially go up. And then the reason it wasn't transitory, which is what the Federal Reserve was saying at the time, is because of the invasion of Ukraine. And when Ukraine was invaded by Russia, the price of oil went to $120 a barrel. Well, you think about that, oil goes into just about everything we buy or do. Food, you wouldn't think a lot of oil goes into food. Well, it does. It goes into oil. It goes into fertilizer. It goes into the tractors that
avocados
that plow the fields.
Yeah, somebody has to provide the wings to the avocados to get them here, and those wings are powered with oil. Indirectly.
And somebody has to put diesel in the tractors, and so the price of petroleum is a big driver in the cost of everything. And when it went to $120 a barrel, it put a price shock into the system. And it's, if you watch the price of oil, and we have over the months of this year, you'll notice that inflation follows the price of oil. As the price of oil has come back down to pretty much the same place it was before the pandemic, the inflation rate keeps dropping. And we'll talk about that some more. That's the big, as a matter of fact, that is probably the number one news item for the week.
I'm going to throw out another one in the middle of that that fits, dovetails nicely into that. The Urals oil price. Now, there's two big oil prices that are quoted around the world. There's what we quote in the United States, the West Texas Intermediate. Then there's the European quote, which is the Brent crude. Brent is the North Brent. Yeah. So
North Sea Brent, yeah.
So those are two different types of oil, and there's lots of different types of oil. Those two are quoted because they're kind of the easiest standard for refining. You can get diesel out of them very easily. You can get gasoline out of them very easily. It's a kind of sweet crude. I don't know who it is that tastes it to figure out if it's sweet. I wouldn't want that job, just saying. But there's quite a number of other indexes out there. But one that's very important is the Urals, URALS index. What is that? It's the price that the Russians get for their oil, because that's where it's from, and that's the name of the oil there. And it's in the mid $50 a barrel, 56 or so at this point. So why is that important? Because the Europeans and the Americans put a price cap on that oil. If you're a tanker company and you're going to ship this oil from Russia to the places it's going to be refined or to a direct buyer somewhere, you need insurance on your tanker. And all the insurance companies, well, I don't think there's any oil tanker insurance companies based in Russia. You got to go to somebody else to get insurance on those tankers, even if you're a Russian ship. And nobody wants to sail through war-infested waters in a non-insured tanker. So nobody's giving insurance if the oil is sold above $60 a barrel. Why is it selling in the mid-50s? If there's a price cap at 60 and anybody else can get it at 80, that's what we get ours at. And the answer is nobody wants to touch it. They're not sure when that price cap gets lowered. And if they just bought it for too much money, that same oil is still Ural oil, and it's still going to have a price cap on it when they go to sell it. So people don't want to touch it. People aren't buying it. And that's a big piece of news for Russia, because 3/4 of its federal budget comes from the sale of oil. And that is going to be a telling sanction during the Ukrainian conflict. There you go. That was my dovetail nicely into that headline to make it a big one, that we're oil prices are down across the board, but Urals oil is way down.
Well, it's also not being bought by a lot of people.
Right. And that's like, why it's
the Europeans are simply not buying it. And then there are a lot of insurance companies that won't insure ships that are carrying oil from Russia. So it's kind of, it's cheap oil, but it's helping us.
It is. And that's good. We're able to sell our oil at higher prices. The United States, unfortunately or fortunately, has benefited very much from the Ukrainian conflict. Fortunately in that it's helping us, but unfortunately, the reasons why we're doing well. Russia has basically excluded itself from the national trade community in a lot of areas, and we've benefited from that.
Well, there's an interesting article that I read, I think it was in The Economist, that makes some sense out of this. Oil in the United States would be about $60 a barrel if it were not for Russia. And the reason I say that is Russia's isolation has produced a shortage of oil in the world. Mm-hmm. And the price of oil went up, and we are one of the world's premier exporters of oil right now. As a matter of fact, I think we're exporting more oil than we're consuming domestically at this point. And so the world oil prices, which we thought we could insulate ourselves from by being a big oil producer in the United States, by being energy independent, which we technically are in one sense, we produce enough oil to supply all the oil we need. We just don't have it the right places. We don't have the pipelines to get it there. So therefore, we export a lot of oil. But since oil overseas is selling, Brent crude sells for more than West Texas Intermediate, even though the Brent crude is technically a higher quality of oil. But still, there's a shortage of oil around the world because of the Russians. As a result, we export a lot of oil, which causes the price of oil in the United States to be higher than it otherwise was. So the one of the great ironies is in the process of becoming energy independent and an oil exporter, the United States has resulted in higher cost of fuel at the gas pump, which is backwards from what you would think, which is the way economics works. A lot of things that you think are common sense, just plain common sense, we should just do it this way. Any idiot can look at this, and that's the point is, any idiot can look at it and see that it should be done this way. It turns out that right now, because we are a major oil exporting country, we're paying more than we would be if we weren't.
It is the reverse psychology of the marketplace. It's true everywhere.
And it's true in everything. And in the demand that we cut our spending in the United States to the point that the Treasury no longer has to borrow money. That is a very deep, gut-felt belief by a lot of people. The fact is, were we to do that, we would put ourselves probably in a depression.
Yeah, and probably the rest of the world too. And this is weird because where do other countries go to protect their assets? There was a time when everybody went to gold to do that because there wasn't really a big standard. And then people went to doubloons Spanish currency,
right.
Way, way back. And then they went to
the pound,
and then they went to the dollar. But it needed to be a currency that had extremely high quality and good controls on its inflationary or deflationary direction. All of those did.
And a very, very large volume.
Had to have enough of it to go around so that these other countries could preserve their reserves as well, the smaller economic countries. The dollar is that now, and the dollar is debt, and the U.S. Treasury bonds are where most of these other countries go to get their dollars. They buy a bond that's going to pay them in dollars, and that bond, first off, we have to get those bonds paid. Let's not do a don't raise the debt ceiling type thing. Let's not shut down the government. Second, there's nothing out there with the volume that we have to replace it. So if we stopped borrowing money, the entire world economy would be put into peril, which is like, it's the backwards of everything because we don't want to have overly much debt. We want to have debt that we can afford and no more. But we also, technically speaking, if we want peace in the world, we don't want to have zero debt either. How's that for craziness? But that's a diplomatic truth that governments need to understand and generally do.
One of the major causes of the Great Depression. The Great Depression, by the way, started off as a recession, and it would have stayed a recession if not for two things that have occurred. And one of the major thing was at that particular moment in time, just under 100 years ago, fiscal conservatives controlled Congress and the presidency, and they determined that we should not be in debt. And what they determined was as tax revenue went down, the government would spend less money. So as the tax revenue dropped into that recession,
that seems common sense.
The Congress approved lower and lower and lower spending by the Treasury. And of course, as the Treasury spent less and less and less money, more and more people lost their jobs since there was lower and lower and lower tax revenue. And so we went into this vicious cycle that ended in about 1934 of the economy slowing, government revenue going down and the government spending less money. And the less money the government spent, the less money was being spent across the board. And people were getting laid off. Military people were getting laid off. Government employees were getting laid off, which meant less revenue was coming in. They were spending less money in the economy to generate even more revenue.
This is a feedback loop. This is feeding on itself.
And of course, the Federal Reserve wasn't helping things because right through 1934, they were raising interest rates to fight inflation because there were two things that everybody seemed to be afraid of at the time. One of them was debt and the other one was inflation. The result is we got a depression that created a world war where the government borrowed more money in relation to the economy than we have borrowed today, which is pretty astonishing. And by borrowing a tremendous amount of money, they dumped a huge, not a huge debt, a huge rush of prosperity upon the country. The post-war economic boom was largely due to borrowed money by the United States government. Now, can we borrow too much money? Certainly, it's possible to borrow too much money. But that doesn't mean that we should be working really, really hard to balance the budget. Because if we balance the United States budget, literally at this point in time, if we balance the United States budget, we would go into a depression. And I know that sounds crazy. The easiest solution I know of is if you own a dollar bill. If you pull out the dollar bill, you look across the top and it says it's a Federal Reserve note. It's signed by the Secretary of the Treasury. It constitutes debt of the United States government. Money, our very money, constitutes government debt. Eliminate government debt and we won't have any money.
Yeah. And so I'm gonna throw in a memory. We can throw back in time here. Go back in time to the end of 2018. On our radio program, we were talking about the times were really amazing. We were moving into a trade war. This was a good time to do that experiment because the booming economy and things were going really, really well. We also did a whole segment on now would be the time to balance the budget. Because in a normal household, you tend to want to balance the budget when things are really bad and you've already grabbed up all the debt and you really shouldn't be pulling back. You should be moving forward. You should be getting more education or whatever to get more income. Where the time to balance the budget is when things are going really, really well. Unfortunately, the wake-up call to the spenders tends to happen when times are bad, not when times are good. So if you do the knee-jerk reaction at the governmental level or at the corporate level for earnings and so on, when things get bad, you balance the budget. That tends to lead to slower growth or shrinkage and you go away and bankruptcy in the case of corporations. It's weird and it's backwards because in a family situation, you do balance the budget when things are bad and you slow things down. Somebody has to be the lender of last resort. Somebody has to be the one with the deep pockets that steps in and says, times are bad. I may make a profit doing this, but I'm going to contribute a bunch of money to the economy to pull it out of this funk. And J.P. Morgan did it famously in 1907. The United States government has done it in the pandemic downturn. Both the Biden and Trump administrations issued stimulus. This might cost us money today, but it'll make us money long term because we won't lose as many employees and tax revenue will stay up. And then we had a series of years with really, really high revenue to the U.S. government. Now we increased spending during that time as well, which isn't necessarily the smartest thing. But what we're trying to say is that some debt is good debt. We just need to get Congress to understand the difference between good debt and bad debt. There. And we've got to play some commercials. We haven't even gotten to our question. Yeah, Inquisitor John. So we'll get to his question. And in his question is a great one. Is it different this time? This time it's different. What's our take on that? So we'll get to that after we're done with commercials. If you'd like to ask some questions, email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. And we are here to talk more of the dreary science, the dismal interpretation of money. It's horrible stuff. Filthy lucre. I have some interesting stuff to bring up, but before we do that, we've got a question hanging out there from Inquisitor John, our most faithful and loyal questioner. It has been, he has sent us more questions than just about everybody else combined, and we appreciate that very much. Thank you, John. His question is, well, it's an email. The subject line is, "This time it's different." Does the personal wealth coach believe things are getting back to normal, or is crisis the new normal? And the headline of the Wall Street Journal that he sent us is, "Investors had it easy last year, but not anymore." And he's circled a paragraph of that article. And it starts with, "It might be time for investors to return to the old thinking. After 3 years of everything being extreme, things are finally returning to normal." And there's a lot more about this, but bubble bursting, pandemic strangeness, and now we're back to normal. And his question here is, do we think things are getting back to normal, or is crisis the new normal? And our answer is in between that. Normal is crisis swinging to not crisis and back to crisis. That's what normal is.
Well, I read the article actually when it was published, so John and I were on the same track in that. Mm-hmm. And it's the Streetwise article from the Wall Street Journal. And first off, Mr. McIntosh often has a lot of good things. James McIntosh writes that. He has a lot of good things to say, but he missed it this time. I can tell you for a fact that it was not easy to invest last year. It was not easy to figure out whether we were, I mean, and with 2020 hindsight, we can, and we said this at the beginning of the program, with 2020 hindsight, you can always look back and say, well, the signals were clearly there that the market was going to go down and bonds were going to collapse because inflation was high and the market was overbought with crazy stuff going on out there.
Yeah, we said all that. But how crazy stuff can go on a long time. In 1994, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Chairman Greenspan, talked about irrational exuberance, but the irrational exuberance didn't bear fruit until 2000. In other words, for the next 6 years, we had a runaway bull market after the market, in his opinion, was already overpriced and everything was out of whack and it was scary to be there. And what followed was 6 years of bull market. So it's not easy to forecast what's coming. The market can get overpriced and get more overpriced and yet get even more overpriced and stay that way for a long time. So it takes a lot of patience and a lot of wisdom. And I think experience helps too. Now, should we get back to normal? No, we're not going to go back to normal. Are we going to stay in crisis? No, we're not going to stay in crisis. We're going to have a new normal.
Well, I would like to even say, what is normal? I mean, if we go back, you said 94, and during the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, all the way back to the mid 40s, we've had a cycle of recessions about every 4 years. That's a move on a four-year period from boom to bust. There's crisis in recessions every time. There are always crisis in recessions. What's the normal part of that four-year cycle? And I would say it's the whole thing. The whole cycle is the normal part. We have these swings where we get overly ambitious and these swings that we get underly ambitious or lose our ambition altogether. What's normal in there? Well, the whole spectrum is. Go ahead.
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen is over the last decade, we had a new definition of normal, like Jake said, what's normal.
Yeah.
But we need to very carefully look at what return to normal, as he's referring to, you need to very carefully take a heavy, strong, long look at what you consider normal and what the reasons are behind it. For example, every person I talk to who's a serious investor who has any idea what's going on out there, all agreed until, and there's still many of them, there's still articles in Morningstar and other places saying the 60-40 portfolio is still the place to be. That assumption is based on the fact that interest rates peaked at a very high level in 1982 and then came down through 2002. So there was a long period, 2022, what am I saying? There was a 40-year period during which interest rates occasionally would bump up a little bit, but the trend clearly was down for 40 years. That is considered the old normal. That is the return to normal, is that bonds will be safe because interest rates will continue to go down.
But
no.
If you look at the preceding 40 years of that, you have a steadily climbing interest rate during that normal time period. So where's the normal?
We're cycling into a new one. And I think this is just purely my opinion. It's not a forecast of the future. It's an educated guess. But I think through the 2020s, you will probably see interest rates relative to their previous decade, relatively high, and probably climbing intermittently. And if you look at the long term, there'll be a trend upward in interest rates through the 2020s. That's just my guess. Now, that's not a forecast of the future.
And I'll throw this out there. In the buildup to the Great Recession, which was fed by cheap loans, the interest rates are what we call cheap on that. And those interest rates are still higher than the mortgage interest rates that we see today. Mm-hmm. Those cheap loans that fueled that speculative frenzy that led to robo signing in Florida and all these big collapses of mortgage-backed securities and all that stuff that we called the Great Recession, those cheap loans were more expensive than the mortgage loans that we're looking at as expensive today, which means that we have more upward movement potential in interest rates, easily more, to be part of a normal long-term history in economics. That means that we will likely see higher interest rates. That's the educated guess from both Baldies there. You can tell people where you're getting these guesses, and if you refer to us as the Baldies, then people will respect you more because we're famous through... No, we're not actually, but we would appreciate the kudos. We're about out of time for this hour. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give customized for our individualized clients investment advice and portfolio management, and you can reach us locally. We have voicemail waiting on the weekends, but real life people during the week, no phone tree, at
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com if you prefer, where you can read our newsletters, sign up for our newsletter, read what they said years ago to see how accurate we were. Our radio program is there as well, and you can find the podcast anywhere that podcasts are provided. You can contact us through our contact form or directly through email at jeff@tpwc.com and or jake@tpwc.com. And we actually read those things. Strange, I know. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening to two bald, boring men talk about finance. And till next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.